There is no suggestion that Congress has, in exercise of its constitutional authority to define and punish offenses against the law of nations, positively identified conspiracy as a war crime. As we explained in Quirin, that is not necessarily fatal to the government's claim of authority to try the alleged offense by military commission. Congress, through Article 21 of the UCMJ, has incorporated by reference the common law of war, which may render triable by military commission certain offenses not defined by statute. When, however, neither of the elements of the offense nor the range of permissible punishment is defined by statute or treaty, the precedent must be plain and unambiguous. To demand any less would be to risk concentrating in military hands a degree of adjudicative and punitive power in excess of that contemplated either by statute or by the Constitution. This high standard was met in Quirin. The violation there alleged was by universal agreement and practice, both in this country and internationally, recognized as an offense against the law of war. Although the picture arguably was less clear in Yamashita, the disagreement between the majority and the dissenters in that case concerned whether the historic and textual evidence constituted clear precedent, not whether clear precedent was required to justify trial by law of war military commission. At a minimum, the government must make a substantial showing that the crime for which it seeks to try a defendant by military commission is acknowledged to be an offense against the law of war. That burden is far from satisfied here. The crime of conspiracy has rarely, if ever, been tried as such in this country by any law of war military commission not exercising some other form of jurisdiction, and does not appear in either the Geneva Conventions or the Hague Conventions, the major treaties on the law of war. Winthrop explains that under the common law governing military commissions, it is not enough to intend to violate the law of war and commit overt acts in furtherance of that intention, unless the overt acts either are themselves offenses against the law of war or constitute steps sufficiently substantial to qualify as an attempt. The government cites three sources that it says show otherwise. First, it points out that the Nazi saboteurs in Quirin were charged with conspiracy. Second, it observes that Winthrop at one point in his treatise identifies conspiracy as an offense prosecuted by military commissions. And finally, it notes that another military historian, Charles Roscoe Howland, lists conspiracy to violate the laws of war by destroying life or property in aid of the enemy as an offense that was tried as a violation of the law of war during the Civil War. On close analysis, however, these sources at best lend little support to the government's position and at worst undermine it. By any measure, they fail to satisfy the high standard of clarity required to justify the use of a military commission. That the defendants in Quirin were charged with conspiracy is not persuasive, since the court declined to address whether the offense actually qualified as a violation of the law of war, let alone one triable by military commission. The Quirin defendants were charged with the following offenses. 1. Violation of the law of war. 2. Violation of Article 81 of the Articles of War, defining the offense of relieving or attempting to relieve or corresponding with or giving intelligence to the enemy. 3. Violation of Article 82, defining the offense of spying. And 4. Conspiracy to commit the offenses alleged in charges 1, 2, and 3. The government, defending its charge, argued that the conspiracy alleged constituted an additional violation of the law of war. The saboteurs disagreed. They maintained that the charge of conspiracy cannot stand if the other charges fall. The court, however, declined to resolve the dispute. It concluded first that the specification supporting charge one adequately alleged a violation of the law of war that was not merely colorable or without foundation. The facts the court deemed sufficient for this purpose were that the defendants admitted enemy combatants, entered upon U.S. territory in time of war without uniform for the purpose of destroying property used or useful in prosecuting the war. That act was a hostile and warlike one. The court was careful in its decision to identify an overt, complete act. Responding to the argument that the saboteurs had not actually committed or attempted to commit any act of depredation or entered the theater or zone of active military operations and therefore had not violated the law of war, the court responded that they had actually passed our military and naval lines and defenses or went behind those lines in civilian dress and with hostile purpose. The offense was complete when with that purpose they entered or having so entered they remained upon, our territory in time of war without uniform or other appropriate means of identification. Turning to the other charges alleged, the court explained that since the first specification of charge 1 sets forth a violation of the law of war, we have no occasion to pass on the adequacy of the second specification of charge 1 or to construe the 81st and 82nd articles of war for the purpose of ascertaining whether the specifications under charges 2 and 3 allege violations of those articles or whether, if so construed, they are constitutional. No mention was made at all of charge 4, the conspiracy charge. If anything, Quirin supports Hamdan's argument that the conspiracy is not a violation of the law of war. Not only did the court pointedly omit any discussion of the conspiracy charge, but its analysis of charge 1 placed special emphasis on the completion of an offense. It took seriously the saboteur's argument that there can be no violation of a law of war, at least not one tribal by military commission, without the actual commission of or attempt to commit a hostile and warlike act. That limitation makes eminent sense when one considers the necessity from whence this kind of military commission grew, the need to dispense swift justice, often in the form of execution, to illegal belligerents captured on the battlefield. The same urgency would not have been felt vis-à-vis enemies who had done little more than agree to violate the laws of war. The Quirin Court acknowledged as much when it described the President's authority to use law of war military commissions as the power to seize and subject to disciplinary measures those enemies who, in their attempt to thwart or impede our military effort, have violated the law of war. Winthrop and Howland are only superficially more helpful to the government. Howland, granted, lists conspiracy by two or more to violate the laws of war by destroying life or property in aid of the enemy as one of over 20 offenses against the laws and usages of war passed upon and punished by military commissions. But while the records of cases that Howland cites following his list of offenses against the law of war support inclusion of the other offenses mentioned, they provide no support for the inclusion of conspiracy as a violation of the law of war. Winthrop, apparently recognizing as much, excludes conspiracy of any kind from his own list of offenses against the law of war. Winthrop does unsurprisingly include criminal conspiracies in his list of crimes and statutory offenses cognizable by state or U.S. courts and tribal by martial law or military government commission. And in a footnote, he cites several Civil War examples of conspiracies of this class, or of the first and second classes combined. The government relies on this footnote for its contention that conspiracy was tribal both as an ordinary crime, a crime of the first class, and independently as a war crime, a crime of the second class. But the footnote will not support the weight the government places on it. As we have seen, the military commissions convened during the Civil War functioned at once as martial law or military government tribunals and as law of war commissions. Accordingly, they regularly tried war crimes and ordinary crimes together. Indeed, as Howland observes, not infrequently the crime, as charged and found, was a combination of the two species of offenses. The example he gives is murder in violation of the laws of war. Winthrop's conspiracy of the first and second classes combined is, like Howland's example, best understood as a species of compound offense of the type tried by the hybrid military commissions of the Civil War. It is not a standalone offense against the law of war, and Winthrop confirms this understanding later in his discussion when he emphasizes that overt acts constituting war crimes are the only proper subject, at least, of those military tribunals not convened to stand in for local courts. Justice Thomas cites as evidence that conspiracy is a recognized violation of the law of war the Civil War indictment against Henry Wirz, which charged the defendant with maliciously, willfully, and traitorously combining, confederating, and conspiring with others to injure the health and destroy the lives of soldiers in the military service of the United States to the end that the armies of the United States might be weakened and impaired in violation of the laws and customs of war. As shown by the specification supporting that charge, however, Wirz was alleged to have personally committed a number of atrocities against his victims, including torture, injection of prisoners with poison, and the use of ferocious and bloodthirsty dogs to seize, tear, mangle, and maim the bodies and limbs of prisoners, many of whom died as a result. Crucially, Judge Advocate General Holt determined that one of Wirtz's alleged co-conspirators, R.B. Winder, should not be tried by military commission because there was as yet insufficient evidence of his own personal involvement in the atrocities. In the case of R.B. Winder, while the evidence at the trial of Wirtz was deemed by the court to implicate him in the conspiracy against the lives of all federal prisoners in rebel hands, no such specific overt acts of violation of the laws of war are as yet fixed upon him to make it expedient to prefer formal charges and bring him to trial. Finally, international sources confirm that the crime charged here is not a recognized violation of the law of war. As observed above, none of the major treaties governing the law of war identifies conspiracy as a violation thereof. And the only conspiracy crimes that have been recognized by international war crimes tribunals, whose jurisdiction often extends beyond war crimes proper to crimes against humanity and crimes against peace, are conspiracy to commit genocide and common plan to wage aggressive war, which is a crime against the peace and requires for its commission actual participation in a concrete plan to wage war. The International Military Tribunal at Nuremberg, over the prosecution's objections, pointedly refused to recognize as a violation of the law of war conspiracy to commit war crimes and convicted only Hitler's most senior associates of conspiracy to wage aggressive war. As one prominent figure from the Nuremberg trials has explained, members of the tribunal objected to recognition of conspiracy as a violation of the law of war on the ground that the Anglo-American concept of conspiracy was not part of the European legal systems and arguably not an element of the internationally recognized laws of war. In sum, the sources that the government and Justice Thomas rely upon to show that conspiracy to violate the law of war is itself a violation of the law of war, in fact, demonstrate quite the opposite. Far from making the requisite substantial showing, the government has failed even to offer a merely colorable case for the inclusion of conspiracy among those offenses cognizable by law of war military commission. Because the charge does not support the commission's jurisdiction, the commission lacks authority to try Hamdan. The charge's shortcomings are not merely formal, but are indicative of a broader inability on the executive's part here to satisfy the most basic precondition, at least in the absence of specific congressional authorization, for establishment of military commissions, military necessity. Hamdan's tribunal was appointed not by a military commander in the field of battle, but by a retired major general stationed away from any active hostilities. Hamdan is charged not with an overt act for which he was caught red-handed in a theater of war and which military efficiency demands be tried expeditiously, but with an agreement, the inception of which long predated the attacks of September 11, 2001 and the AUMF. That may well be a crime, but it is not an offense that by the law of war may be tried by military commission. None of the overt acts alleged to have been committed in furtherance of the agreement is itself a war crime, or even necessarily occurred during the time of or in a theater of war. Any urgent need for imposition or execution of judgment is utterly belied by the record. Hamdan was arrested in November 2001, and he was not charged until mid-2004. These simply are not the circumstances in which, by any stretch of the historical evidence or this court's precedents, a military commission authorized and established by executive order under the authority of Article 21 of the UCMJ may lawfully try a person and subject him to punishment.